Yes.
At a previous meeting, you were telling us about when you went in India and you lived in isolation. Why do you need to go and live in isolation to meditate? Why can't you just meditate in a society like this?
Right. It's a very good question. Very good question. It even says in Bhagavad Gita and other scriptures, even in the Bible, where it says from time to time one should seek a solitary place. But, of course, many can't. And when they do, you know, they have an opportunity. They just want to have some fun. What's the motive? Why are we being told by Scripture and the saints and masters to retreat somehow? Because we have a tendency, as humans, we tend to want to shift the blame. You know what I mean? We can say, you know, my mind is kind of a mess, and I'm not really doing too well spiritually because, you know, my job stinks. My relationships are kind of rocky. I don't have enough money. I'm sick and I can't provide. And so we can tend to say all the circumstances that are surrounding us are influencing us in such a way that they're obstacles that are preventing us from going deep and being really aware of what's going on inside. So, literally what I've been told, of course, there's many answers to this question. Of course, you can go into a reflective place where it's beautiful, nature is very conducive, and those things start to control and relax the mind, and then you slip into a more contemplative state. But those who are serious about spiritual practice and really want to cure the disease of the frailty of human nature, they'll go to a secluded place, surrounded by nature, surrounded by all beauty and quiet. The food will be provided. Every disturbance will be quelled. And then they'll go inside in meditation and find a volcanically erupting mind. So they'll realize it's inside of me. It has nothing to do with outside. I'm a bundle of thoughts. A lot of it has to do, of course, from past lives and things. And even they say, when you get in a secluded place and you get the mind still, then you start to transform and evolve. Holy Mother Sri Saradevi, the consort of Sri Ramakrishna, spoke very plainly about this. And she said, when you get into a contemplative place, a place of nature, or seclusion, and the mind really starts to become relaxed, and you're doing a spiritual practice, which is transformative, mantra japa, prayer, just trying to be still and just control things. At that point, the heart starts to literally unwind the mind. She said that the mind and the thoughts and the patterns and the consequences of actions, or karmas, are literally according to the gunas. The tamasic being black thread, in a sense, red thread for rajasic, white thread for sattvic. We're literally, she said, the mind is like a school, and as we go from life to life to life, or even from early in life, on to where we are now, we're spooling up consequences of actions and thoughts. When you become still and things are relatively calm and we're trying to do some spiritual practice, at that point, literally grace comes upon us. We become receptive. And the mind starts to unspool these things. And what Holy Mother Sri Saradevi said is, the way it went in is the way it comes out. If you had dark, even negative actions that reaped negative consequences, those black threads in the mind, as you become reflective and contemplative in a secluded place, it starts to literally come through what you might say your perception of your consciousness. And so what you do is you just sit. And you just sit and be patient and you witness it. This is why it's conducive if we're in a place where we're not going to be disturbed by telephones or visitors or whatever, work, all these things, then we can sit through it and let it work itself out. And the efficaciousness of this is tremendous. See, again, now we're not going just to kind of like relax and be with nature. we're going so we can remove all of the disturbances and so we can literally sit out and bear the heat of the bundle of the mind's thoughts. This is where Mother Anandamayi, Sri Anandamayi Ma, she used the word tapa sahana. The Sanskrit word tapa comes from tapas, which means heat. Sahana means bearing the heat, sitting through it. She said this was even a more efficacious practice than deep samadhi, where literally you're secluded, you're in a room, whatever, you can just dedicate time, morning and evening of meditation period, and you sit. And then the mind starts to travel, the emotions start to come up, and we just pull the mind back. And it becomes heat producing if you sit through it and allow this the mind to let go. That's literally what we're doing, letting go.
Let's just go back to the beginning of the statement where you were speaking about the average person, and for all of us living, we've got problems with not enough money, relationships, work, etc.
Right.
Which is really, isn't that our karma that we're dealing with on a daily basis? And therefore, if we start to meditate, doesn't that start to give us some insight of how to handle all the suffering that's going on?
Right, exactly. Well, you see, you've talked upon pretty much the key to what we're really after in the process of transformation. You say, this is all our karma. What exactly are we talking about when we're saying, this is our karma? Karma is produced from an action and a reaction. Okay? We do something and we get a reaction. If we have the proper reaction, let's say for instance someone insults us, if we start bearing heat and anger for that person, this is heavy karma and it's going to stay with us. Okay? And then later on in life, we're going to have the opportunity through karma revisiting us. They call this prarabdha karma, even from a past life, where someone, again, is aggressive and we get angry. How we're going to alleviate or burn up that karma is to be in that situation again where someone is abusive or a situation is threatening and we don't react in a reactionary, aggressive way. Jesus said, turn the other cheek. The Buddha said, just let go. So karma is literally then, if we can see it, spiritual opportunity. It's not fate that, you know, we just try to avoid it. So when we have something happen in our life which is difficult to deal with, even illness, loss, or even great gain and happiness, if we can stay steady and not react, this will burn up the karma. So the idea is, you're absolutely right, that what we're trying to do is become calm and non-reactive. And this is the whole gist of the Bhagavad Gita, to literally say, don't seek the fruits of actions, don't seek the response of consequences. It's called steady in wisdom. And it takes lifetimes to do. This is why we find when we're trying to spiritualize our life and we get in despair, we think, you know, I've meditated for 20 years and still I have the same problems. Or they seem to have gone away and then they come back. And so many of the scriptures and many of the saints and masters of our religion say, the contract with God called human life is 10% our effort, 90% God's effort. So therefore, the devotion aspect of say, help me, be merciful, help this, because it's overwhelming, because we're habitual creatures and we're human. And like we said at the beginning of this talk, we're sensitive. It's not easy when someone just literally they take away something you love. Or they demean you in such a cruel, heartless way. It's not easy to just, we're not going to do it. Because we're sensitive and we're habitual creatures. We're creatures of habit. This is where Ramana Maharshi said, when he was asked, what are the obstacles to liberation? He said, the obstacles are the habits of the mind. So breaking habits, as we know, sometimes prayer is pretty helpful because we tend to say, I can't move without that coffee. Or, you know, I just can't help. You know, I'm doing okay and then someone just comes on and just says something cruel. Or I'm doing okay and then someone accuses me falsely or accuses me justly. And I just react. The key is these circumstances are literally, in a sense, gifts from God, because God's motive is to get us to change and manifest this divinity. Okay? Any questions? Let me ask, does anyone have difficulty with meditation? That we want to talk about the practice? No, keep it on. The practice of meditation? Because there are many.
When you start to meditate, I think one of the problems you have is, am I meditating or am I falling asleep?
Right.
And the time could go by very quickly, and you could come out of it, and you don't really know if you've been meditating or sleeping.
Right.
That happens to me. I mean, an hour could go by and I wake up, but I've been sleeping.
Right.
And I don't know whether I've been sleeping or meditating.
Right. We can look to the Patanjali Yoga Sutras for the answer. Patanjali actually, you know, who is considered the greatest exponent of that descriptive practice of meditation, and what to do, what are we trying to achieve in meditation, how do we know we're achieving it. He said basically that meditation was effective and correct when you find a combination of tranquility with complete and acute awareness. So obviously a sleep state, there's tranquility, but that consciously aware state is not there. And the problem is because when you get the body relaxed, if the mind is fatigued or stressed or diseased in any way, or even, you know, wanting to just relax, it'll go to sleep. So what they do is they say there are certain things you can do on the physical level, on the mental level, and even on the higher, maybe astral level. The first thing you do is you sit up straight. And, you know, you get comfortable. And you get, this is why Hatha Yoga is helpful, because you can sit calmly and straight with the body, with the trunk, the neck, and the head in one plane without having fatigue, and do it for long enough. But the mental thing that you do is probably what Patanjali and all the great masters that came before and even after him talk about. They say there's a practice of watching the breath, because we have to have, you might say, an anchor. You have to have something to keep the mind focused on, or else you'll drift off. And even the ego can trick us and stop all thoughts, because it says, if I can just put that consciousness to sleep, then I can rest myself. So when we watch the breath, we're literally watching the inhalation and exhalation and the movement of the breath. This is enough focus to keep the mind from just drifting down and becoming lethargic and drift into sleep. So they'll say, you just literally watch the breath. Those who do mantra japa, or they say God's name, they'll link the movement of the breath with the movement of the mantra. If they're saying the Vedic, only Vedic mantra or Om, with the inhalation, they'll be all mentally, Om. With the exhalation, Om. Now, we're trying to get to a state where we're in a suspended, still, and divine state. So they say there's three things going on in meditation which will alleviate and keep us away from falling asleep. The first is we're watching the breath, so we're engaging in movement. Huh? Then you say, you know, Dracula said, the blood is the life. Okay? For the mind, thought is the life. The lifeblood of the mind is thought, and thought is movement. So we have to maintain movement to keep us aware and focused, and also, but not have movement of various and millions of thoughts. So we watching the movement of the breath. Okay, that satisfies that lower mind's need and urge to move with thoughts. And also there is a divine connection between the breath and the ascent. This is why Ramana Maharshi said, you can follow the eye thought to its source or follow the breath to the source. So we're watching the breath. That's the first thing. That gives us the attentive focus. And now let's say we're using Om or sacred mantra. And this is a transforming process. The third thing is, we're aware that this mantra or this Om is literally invoking a divine presence. And we can feel it. What happens in the process of meditation, as you become more and more deep and relaxed and deeper, the breath, attention of the breath, and the sound of the mantra become attenuated. They become very slight, even to the point that they become imperceivable. But as they're becoming slight and attenuated, this presence of God is looming more and more, and you're becoming steeped in this divine consciousness. Now, the consciousness of God is pure alertness, pure consciousness. It's light. It's not asleep at all.
Now, if I'm going to be focusing on a mantra,
right,
and I'm consciously saying that as I breathe in and out, I'm now blocking any possibilities of any thoughts coming into my mind. So I'm really cheating, aren't I?
Well, there, here, in a sense, yes. And this is why in the preliminary stages, our focus is to block out the other thoughts. This is what they say. The most gross description of meditation is to reduce the multifarious thoughts with one thought. It's a preliminary process. We're moving, as it says in the Uddhava Gita, in a conciliatory way. We're not just saying, okay, thoughtless, divine. It's not going to happen with the majority of people. So you're bringing it down. But the key is this mantra or this pranava, this Om, is God's name. And as we talked about at the beginning, the processes, the powers of the Atman, we're bringing that into our consciousness. Now it's starting to absorb and transform. So it's literally divinizing us. And it's drawing that invocation of that. So what happens is the mind gets to a sublime state. This is a sublimation process. We're taking that which is on a gross level, that is the normal functioning mind, and making it sublime. And as it becomes sublimated, it becomes focused and really conscious and alert. So we do get to a state where we're sitting perfectly still. The movement of the breath is out of sight, out of mind. The sound of the mantra is no longer within our realm of attention. But what is there is just this presence of God. And it is focused and alert. Yes?
What's the proper way to chant Om?
Proper way to chant Om is, if you were to say matric, M-A-T-R-A-C, or units of time, the O should have equal time as the M. Some people like to have a long O and a quick M at the end. Like, Om. It's really, if you were to say, mentally you would say Om for like 6 seconds. The first three should be the O. The last three should be M. So it would be Om. Like that. Yes?
I would have thought there were three sounds. It was
A. Yeah. There is A-U-M. The Om, A-U-M. But in Sanskrit, the way that it is, when it's written in the Devanagari script, there is, you know, we have an Om here anywhere. Anyway, there is the what looks like a three, that's the ah, and then the line, that's the oo, and the bindu, this dot on is the m. Ah, oo, mm. But when you take that Devanagari written script and you say it, the au turns into an o. Let's say if you're saying the word kapha Upanishad, you know, the word, that Upanishad, K-A-T-H-A, then U for the Upanishad. When you say it, it becomes Katha Upanishad. The A-U becomes an O sound. When you take the written Devanagari script and speak it, A-U combines into O. So written, it's yes, A-U-M, and that, of course, has a lot of mystical meaning, the physical realm, the mental realm, the astral realm, and the different, you know, planes of consciousness, all that. But in terms of invoking it as a mantra, the A-U turns into O, so now it's O-M, OM, OM, OM. That's exactly all it is. So, and then people may not understand that. They may not have, you know, studied the scriptures enough or familiar with the tradition of Sanatana Dharma. So they'll go, oh, it just doesn't work. That's why you have to know the language. You have to know, you know, that means OM.
Back to the process of meditation, when you are chanting the mantra or doing japa and there's thoughts that you know, like you said, most people cannot just get rid of all
right.
the thoughts. So the thoughts are happening and you're aware of the thoughts, right? You're just not
very much aware and sometimes carried off by them.
Okay.
And so in here, what I didn't read, again in this preliminary chapter, talking about that jnana yoga, they're saying, okay, you're trying to control an unruly horse with the view of making him conform. This is, they're talking about the human mind. How do you do it? So in the commentary, they're saying, as a breaker of a horse has to run some distance with the animal, holding however the reins tight in his hands, so the yogi, in certain cases, should allow the mind to wander a little, keeping a strict watch on its movements, and then little by little gain mastery over it. Because, you see, as Sri Ramana Maharshi and the great masters say, it's the habits of the mind we're trying to dismantle. You need to become familiar with this is introspection of the mind. What are our habits? Just, you know, if you start to say, if you're getting very meditative, and you're watching the mind just a little in the direction it goes. Then you pull it back. Then it'll go in another direction. But if you're aware, this is why people say you keep a spiritual diary about your meditation. What happened in my meditation? I kept going back to this one train of thought, predominantly. I had a lot, but this is one thing. The idea is, this is linked with some karmic habit which is ripe to be broken or embedded even worse. So this is, you witness it, but you only let the mind do it a little. They emphasize a little. Because if you give too much rein, then literally, they're wild horses, you're not going to go in the direction you want.
So by giving it a little awareness or attention, are you unspooling those threads of the mind that you were talking
Yes
about?
And no. Mostly yes. The unspooling of the mind happens with perseverance, patient perseverance. You just have to sit through it. That's why they say you meditate morning and evening. You have a regimented time, and you'll get to know what is the right time. Because, in fact, I was with someone this morning who doesn't have a very regimented form of meditation. And this person meditates quite a bit, but only when they say, I'm in the mood. And so I said, you know, and usually it's 7 o'clock or so after a long sleep. And, you know, and of course, the tradition says you get up in the early morning hours before sunrise. Because this time, this Brahma Muhurt time, God kind of like pulls some of the difficulty away. And it's easier to kind of, and the grace is more available, or our receptivity is increased, really. So this person said, okay, this morning at your advice, I got up at 4 o'clock and I meditated for an hour. Then I just felt so sick and tired and just, and you know, so I'm not going to do it anymore. This is the mind is out of control. Because, and I was trying to say, we didn't have a lot of time to discuss it, this was a good meditation. You know, You got up, you dedicated, want to improve. All the necessities are there, and all of the yearning is there. It's just, you know, I'm going to lose my sleep. I'm going to like feel tired next thing. I know my wrinkles are going to start to get more profound, and you know I can't think. So you have to like, well, you do what you can. You don't get up at 4. In fact, the night before I was talking to this person, I said, well, just instead of going to bed at midnight, go to bed at 11 or maybe 45 minutes earlier. So instead of getting up at 6, you get up at 5:15. So, of course, the advice wasn't taken. Got up at 4, which was, didn't have enough sleep because went to bed at 12 or 1. And so the whole thing is counterproductive. See, we have to understand, if we understand the Bhagavad Gita, it's a war. And in the Bhagavad Gita, you look at chapter 1, the powers, the dark powers, or the Kauravas, are 11 legions. The Pandavas, or the virtuous powers, are 7. That means we're outnumbered by the negative, or, you know, and so. But even if you look at the Buddha, and all of his description in the different commentaries and the sutras, he's giving, even though the Buddha is the epitome and the embodiment and the manifestation of nonviolence and, you know, non-reaction. So many, the majority of his descriptions, he was a great storyteller, and a lot of his analogies deal with soldiers and war and different acts of this kind of engagement, because he's talking about dealing with the mind. So you have to like, this is why Jesus said, put on the armor of righteousness, the buckler and the shield. And you know, you look at Jesus, he stormed through the, you know, the temple, knocked down the money changers. You know, the Buddha was known to be at times ferocious. Look at all the gods, look at whatever religion we follow. The masters at time, well, what does it say even in the Bible? They took heaven by storm. They weren't lilies in the field, because they realized, you know, this is serious and we have limited time.
I was reading about the Dalai Lama, and what I got out of it was his number one message is compassion.
Absolutely.
So isn't it in conflict with what you just said?
In a sense, when you say you have compassion on others, if you're, and that's basically what he's talking about, forgiveness, compassion, benevolence, loving kindness. To do it properly, there must be sincerity, true to the core, you mean it. That takes spiritual development. It's just not an idea. This is to the core, to your heart. You're ready to give your life. That's the greatest compassion. You're ready to do anything for your friend or someone you love. You're ready to put aside all of your own wants for the sake of the goodness of the world, uplifting the world. In fact, someone I was speaking with yesterday said, you know, I'm doing everything to help those around me, but I'm not getting any kind of nourishment here. So I'm setting a time limit on this. And it was understanding, because you get burned out. But the idea is, so true compassion is pure, unselfish compassion. It takes development. It takes a faith. You have a higher ideal. You're not doing it just to be good. It's dharma. It's righteousness. And to develop that sincerity, you have to have conviction. You have to have all these qualities of purity. This is why Sri Ramakrishna said, if you have sincerity, you have everything. So, yes, you exercise human compassion in all walks of life, but you do something to be pure and resolved and developed. Does that make sense?